Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, reporter Wayne Baker brings us information on Issue 25 on the ballot this Tuesday in Clark County. Emily McCord has this week's Politics Ohio, and selections from this year's Antioch Writers Workshop continue this month. Today, we'll hear from author Holly Efron. Up first, the 2012 Dayton Literary Peace Prize Awards ceremony will be held on November 11th at the Schuster Center. The award honors authors from around the world who are using their world to help promote peace. WISO's Juliet Fromholt spoke with Sharon Rabb, founder and co-chair of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, about this year's honorees. First, we begin with a little history.
The Dayton Literary Peace Prize came out of Dayton A Peace Process, which was the group that gave the Dayton Peace Prize to Richard Holbrooke in 2005. And I was on the board that was presenting that award to Richard Holbrooke. And at that time, I had had a television show for years called Writer to Writer. Over all those years, the writers kept telling me they love to come to Dayton, Ohio, because Dayton was a reading community. And that might be something that might come as a surprise to people, that we are known throughout the literary community as a community that reads and as a community that responds well to writers. And I had had major writers who would come in 3 and 4 times because they were at Books & Co. And they came on my show and they just kept complimenting Dayton. And so as I sat there and I was listening to the board, I just said, I think it would be a good idea if we started a Dayton Literary Peace Prize. And like every good committee, they said, fine, Sharon, go do that. But I started researching, and what I found out was that there was no Literary Peace Prize in the United States, and there were only two others in the world. And one was in Canada, specific to Canadians. The other was in Germany, the Erich Remarque Award that goes to people from all over, but tends to focus on European writers. So then I realized we did have a niche. There was a need for this. And so a number of people, once the award was given to Richard Holbrooke, a number of people from that board joined me in creating the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, among them my current co-chair, Mark Meister, Tom Lasley at University of Dayton, Doris Ponence. This group of us became the core to create the Dayton Literary Peace Prize. We started fundraising. We went to the universities first. The universities were very generous because I think they saw that there would be something that their students could gain from having these wonderful authors in town. And so the first award was, in fact, that next year in 2006. And we give 3 awards. One at that time was called the Lifetime Achievement Award. And that idea came from Vic McCunis here at this station. And he said, you know, we really ought to think about that. And it hadn't occurred to me at that point because we were brand new and it seemed, wow, to do a Lifetime Achievement Award. But Vic was absolutely right. And he helped us get Studs Terkel to come to town for his valedictory speech. We give an award in adult fiction and an award in adult nonfiction, and we have runners-up in those 2 categories as well.
In talking about the Lifetime Achievement Award, this year's recipient is Tim O'Brien, who is a very well-respected author, in particular for the things they carried, and he's also a veteran.
Right.
Tell me about the choice to honor him this year, and the question has been raised many times about the idea of books about war that are actually in celebration of peace, and if you could speak to that a little bit as well.
It's interesting to me that every year there's some kind of synchronicity that happens, and certainly this year it's true with Tim O'Brien in that our event falls on Veterans Day. That honestly was not planned that we would do that. In fact, it didn't occur to us later how totally appropriate that was, that it was going to happen for us this year. But if you read the things they carried, going after Cacciato in the Lake of the Woods, all of these things that are so close to my particular generation about what happened in Vietnam and the horrific situations that came out of Vietnam and all the controversy that arose in the United States over Vietnam, the fact that Tim is read in both high school and college, as well as in by the general readership, that he has become part of the canon. And I think that that is so important for people to hear his voice coming out of the Vietnam War. And we maintain that any good book about war is, in fact, a book about peace, because it shows the necessity of striving to have any alternative to the kind of horrific situation that these men and women faced in Vietnam. And Tim brings it home to us through short story, through his short story collection, The Things They Carried, through his novels. And he reminds us, book after book after book, of how important peace is to us and how important it is to not stumble into another war like Vietnam.
And likewise, going along with that idea of learning from experiences of war and building peace out of that, the nonfiction winner writes about the Great War, World War One, to end all the book to end all wars. Quite the synchronicity this year.
Well, it really was, because it was absolutely remarkable that, okay, once again, we have Tim O'Brien. It's Veterans Day, and our two winners are about World War One that started Armistice Day that led into Veterans Day. So, yes, it is perfect synchronicity. And actually, Andrew Kreebach's book, The Sojourn, isn't about building afterwards. In fact, it's about a young man, a Czechoslovakian, Andrew Kruvac is a Czechoslovakian who immigrated to the United States and now teaches in Boston. And he told the stories of his family through this book, stories that he heard both his grandmother and his mother tell about their memories of what they heard in the family about the Great War. And so he combined these stories and created a character who was, in fact, born in the United States, but after a tragedy in Colorado, moved back to his father's home country of Czechoslovakia and became a shepherd. And as a shepherd, he was trained as a sharpshooter without realizing he was being trained as a sharpshooter to kill any of these scavengers who were coming after the sheep. He became a very good shot. And so he was drafted into the Austro-Hungarian army during World War One, and was taken to northern Italy as a sharpshooter, and he was on the front there. And it takes him from the time that he is a shepherd and then joins the war, and then through a stint in the war, and then back home. And like Remarque with Drei Kameraden, Three Comrades, he shows the aftermath of what happens to young men who go to war, just as Tim O'Brien does with the Vietnam War. Adam Hochschild's book is fascinating in that he focuses on Great Britain, and he takes warriors and he takes pacifists, and he traces them through the Great War from the British point of view, and he moves us in the prelude to World War One, including the Boer Wars and great times when people were still celebrating the cavalry as the primary weapon, and then he shows how tragically that misunderstanding of what war was going to become with the trench warfare that was created for World War One, and what a horrific situation that was. In tracing the pacifists, he also showed the frustrations that they faced in trying to talk with the British people about stopping the war, even as the war was going on. So he does quite a bit with Rudyard Kipling, and Kipling is I wouldn't say a warmonger, but as a man who promoted the war as a writer through both poetry and prose, and then the tragic loss of his son, Kipling's son, in the Great War that he really never got over.
The events of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize go quite beyond just the ceremony on Sunday night. There, it's kind of a weekend celebration, and there are things that the public can participate in, even if they aren't going to the awards ceremony. Tell me a little bit about some of those opportunities.
Yes, the universities and actually high schools and universities pull together and have a number of events where the public is invited. The authors who are winners, the former winners who are presenters, and the judges might be asked by one of the colleges or universities to appear, and that is absolutely true this year. One of our judges, Christopher Cerf, is going to be lecturing at Sinclair, for instance, on Saturday morning to early childhood educators, because Christopher, in addition to the many things he has done, was a founder of Sesame Street and has written all the music and has developed an entire program of English language learning that he is going to be sharing with the early childhood people. And those are any early childhood people in the area would be invited to that. There's a poetry reading that is going to happen. There is a contest by Antioch Midwest University where people have been submitting writing to a writing contest, and then there is going to be a reading of all of these things at Antioch University Midwest. So things like that have been and will be happening throughout the community. And for a complete list on our website, www.daytonliterarypeaceprize.org, if you go up to the upper right-hand corner and you pull down under Outreach, you will see the various things under the College and University Consortium that will be listed that will be free and open to the public.
Thank you so much for being here today, Sharon.
Well, thank you, Juliet, for inviting us.
And stay tuned to WISO Weekend all next month. We'll be bringing you speeches from the winning authors during the month of December, and we'll air an hour-long special on this year's event on New Year's Day. Thanks for joining us. This is WISO Weekend. This month, we resume our series of faculty readings from this summer's Antioch Writers Workshop. Today, we'll hear a selection from Holly Efron, author of over 10 books and an award-winning book reviewer for the Boston Globe. She'll read from her newest book, Come and Find Me, but first gives some background on the story.
I'm so happy to be here, to be a writer, because I love books. I actually love them much more than I love writing. In Come and Find Me, I'm writing about a young woman who's been traumatized. She was climbing in the Alps, and her boyfriend fell to his death. And she's returned. She's agoraphobic. She's in the house. She lives on the internet in something like Second Life, if you know what that is. She's got an avatar and blah, blah, blah. Anyway. She's surrounded by security cameras, locks, double locks, and she's always checking the outside of the house. And so she looks outside, and through one of the cameras, she sees the white picket fence outside, and there's a cardinal sitting on the fence. Nothing else. A half hour later, she looks out, and there's the cardinal again. A half hour later, she looks out, and there's the cardinal again. And she realizes that the video feed is not real. There's a loop. And she's not seeing what's really outside. So that's, again, the light bulb in the glass of milk. Now, she does eventually have to leave the house and go look for her sister, who goes missing. Her sister is Ashley. And although I loved writing about a woman in a hacker's world, which is what Come and Find Me is about, I had the most fun writing in a book that was about sisters and their relationship with their mother, which is, by the way, totally made up. But the little excerpt I'm going to read you is the sisters. And here's Diana, who's just realized her sister Ashley might not be just trying to piss her off by not returning her calls. Maybe she's really disappeared. So this is part of the scene. She calls her mother. What's wrong, her mother said, the minute she heard Diana's voice on the phone. Why should there be anything wrong? Because you never call me. I call you. Your sister calls me. That's the way things work in this family. So has she? Why is it always a contest? Diana took a breath. Let's start over. Hi, Ma. How are you? For the last 5 years, her mother had lived in Jensen Beach, Florida, in a condo surrounded by golf courses. men golf, she'd explained to Diana, forever hopeful that she'd find a better partner than Diana's father, who disappeared from their life long before he'd taken off with a woman whom Diana and Ashley referred to as Tiffany, because that was her favorite place to shop. She had not long after been replaced by Tiffany, too. Sorry, and this is her mother, do I sound cranky? I can't complain. Few creaky joints. I always thought that was a figure of speech, but it turns out they do creak and click. It's unnerving. I mean, I make a fist and the knuckles make this sound. And my back. The doctor tells me to walk more, says it's normal for my age. Do you think he's telling me that because there's nothing for it? Like I say, I can't complain. Her mother snorted a laugh. Guess I can. Ha ha, in fact, I'm really good at complaining. But actually, on the whole, and considering everything, I'm good. Hey, I beat the big C. What else can he throw at me? Carpe diem, that's what I say. Carpe diem every goddamn day. How about you, sweetie pie? Her mother actually paused. Diana waited until she was certain her mother wasn't going to answer the question herself. I'm good. Good? Just good? That's nice, I guess. You getting out of the some? Good. I'm glad you're getting out, and if you're not, take vitamin D supplement. You don't want to get osteoporosis when you get to my age. There was a moment of silence. You know, all I want is for you to be happy. Your sister tells me. Did she call? Last week. She was supposed to call this morning, Monday morning. She calls usually on Monday mornings. Monday morning, Ashley usually answered her voice messages and showed up at work, too. Has something happened to your sister, her mother said, because all weekend I felt like something was off. I thought it was me. Then today she doesn't call and you do. Is something up? Nothing's up. I haven't heard from her either. Since Friday. Ah. Did you check her apartment? She's not answering her phone. Because she's not there? Or the silence that followed felt laden with accusation, and an image of Ashley lying on her kitchen, paralyzed, unable to reach the phone, floated into Diana's head. Her mother went on, I'm sure she'll show up, hon. She always does. Try not to worry too much. 2 years ago, Diana would have been the one trying to reassure her mother. Good advice. I'm full of good advice. Don't you know that? Thanks, Ma. I'll tell her to call. Bye. Shh! Her mother cut her off. From the day she'd been diagnosed with cancer, Diana's mother insisted that they never end a conversation with any version of goodbye. Sorry, I meant talk to you soon, Diana said. Knockwood.
Holly Efron speaking at the Antioch Writers Workshop. We'll have another selection for you next week. This is Why So Weekend.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the last week of middle fall. I wake up to leaves from the redbud tree and the white mulberry tree on the lawn where I raked just yesterday. Today, I'm going to just look and listen. When I'm sitting on the porch, I hear two osage fruits fall into the great open palms of the Lenten roses near the west fence. At the pond, our five koi lie low on the bottom, subdued by the autumn. Pale grape leaves streak the honeysuckle hedge. Even though the hummingbird food slowly disappears, it seems that the bees are the only one drinking. A white bindweed has blossomed near the trellis, and Ruby's white flocks have a few new flowers. All the finches at the feeders have turned for winter. Into the woods, the canopy is opening in front of me. Zigzag goldenrod and all the asters are half gone in the undergrowth. Smartweed is blanched by the frost. Drifts of snake root have gone to seed, brown and gray. Deep patches of goldenrod are all rusted, flowers and leaves matching now. Wood nettle is spotted and drooping. Wingstem and ironweed are twisted, sagging and brittle. Climbing bittersweet is undressed and bright. The pale underside of the blackberry leaves turn over in the warm east wind. And this varied, mottled land reflects the motion of the sky. tells the rising of Orion up into the night. This leaf following red Antares, and that leaf there prophesying Betelgeuse. Open bittersweet along the path uncovers the Milky Way above me. Myopia takes everything in hand. In the glow of ripeness, the stars of November fall around me. Everything is here. All of the facts are in. I need look no further than the undergrowth for Taurus and the Pleiades. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the first week of late fall. In the meantime, watch and listen.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
On Tuesday, Clark County voters will be asked to approve Issue 25. The Developmental Disabilities Board is seeking to approve a new $1.75 million 8-year levy. WISO's Wayne Baker spoke with Board Superintendent Jennifer Rauskulp about the details of Issue 25.
Okay, now we know Issue 25 is to help people with disabilities in the Clark County area. Can you tell us about the issue and, you know, why it's important?
And it will provide funds for the F.F. Mueller Center. We provide day services as well as residential services at the Mueller Center. Provides funding for our early childhood center and developmental specialists that do services for young children 0 to 3 in our early intervention programs. We have Quest Adult Services, which serves adults for day programs during the day, which allows families then to send their loved ones to in our care during the day so that they can go to work and continue to be a vital part of our community. It provides residential services through contracted agencies such as Champaign Residential and Self-Reliance, New Neighbors. We have several contracted providers that provide services in people's homes all across our county. It also provides funding for some of our contracted entities that do other services. The YMCA does Camp Journey for our young children to have camp, just like any other child is able to have camp in the summertime. It provides funds for TAC Enterprises, who provides employment opportunities for individuals with disabilities. That's been a longstanding tradition here in our community. So it provides for many folks, 1,100 people we serve, and it's critical to maintain and continue services. One of those reasons is our numbers have grown. When we were on the ballot last time, it was 2003, and in 2003, we said that we wouldn't need to come back to the voter for 5 years, and we've stayed off the ballot for going on 9 years. And the reason we've been able to do that is we're very fiscally prudent with our dollars. We've made some significant changes in our efficiency and how we've been able to maximize bringing in Medicaid dollars at the federal level in order for us to continue services and not be so reliant on our local tax dollars. When we are successful on November 6th, we will not need to come back to the voter until 2020. And we take great pride in using our dollars very efficiently for this community.
If this levy passes, and you talk about what that meant, but if this levy does not pass, can you share with us what that will mean to the people that you serve?
Well, what that will mean is that we will have in the next couple years, we will be short $4 million in our services. And what will happen is our numbers as far as waiting lists will continue to grow as opposed to us serving people. And that really hits home, particularly for those families that have students right now in high school with a disability. And as they come out of high school, there will be no services available for them. They will have to be placed on a waiting list. We will not have be able to afford the day service programs for them. Additionally, we will have, it also will affect others. We have contracted employees. We actually provide over 1,000 private sector jobs within our service arena. And so it would be less jobs in the private sector because, again, we won't be able to enroll new people or provide additional supports as people need them, and so they will have to go without. This is very challenging and a difficult situation. We truly are one of the economic drivers of Clark County in keeping this a great place to live.
People usually gauge economically what they can and can't do in terms of a levy. What will this cost the owner of a $100,000 home? That's usually the barometer used. And are you worried that sort of in a tough economic climate, people will shy away from approving a new levy?
Well, first, the financial component. This will cost a homeowner of a $100,000 value property $5.10 a month. As far as the economic component, and I do know that there are many families here that aren't making the money that they were, that they're still having challenges, but I also know that we provide jobs. We also provide support for people with disabilities in this community, and it will make Clark County continue to be attractive.
Well, Jennifer, I wanted to thank you for breaking down so much information about Issue 25.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. Just a few days now before the election, and Ohio clearly remains a state to watch. Today, I'm joined by Karen Kassler. She's the State House Bureau Chief for Ohio Public Radio. Thanks for being here.
No problem.
This weekend, it's a bonanza of campaigning here in Ohio. The president's crisscrossing the state throughout the weekend, and Mitt Romney is holding sort of a super rally with GOP surrogates. There seems to be a lot of focus lately on the southwest part of Ohio. What's the strategy there?
Well, it sure looks like Hamilton County is going to be a big, big area that may be in play here. I mean, we always hear about Columbus being in play, and I think that's you're seeing that in the candidates both deciding to stop by Columbus on their way to Election Day. But also the idea that Hamilton County is a big deal, it potentially could be a swing. I mean, Mitt Romney barely won Hamilton County back during the primary. And obviously Obama looks at the cities as being a big place to win in Ohio. And so Hamilton County is going to be a major county that a lot of folks are going to be watching, and that's why the candidates are stopping there.
You know, one thing that Ohioans are talking about is this whole controversy surrounding the comments and ads by the Romney campaign saying that Jeep Chrysler is moving production to China. Jeep, GM and Democrats are saying that's not true. What impact, if any, could this have on Tuesday's outcome?
We've got some people who are comparing it to the Swift Boat ads back in with John Kerry, this idea of trying to throw in a last-minute, very damaging thing to try to sway the few voters who may not have voted, who may be still on the fence. So it's really a last-minute, very almost insanely crazy idea thrown in there at the 11th hour, so to speak. And, you know, Mitt Romney is saying that he's standing behind this. He actually expanded his ad buy on this. And the Democrats and the unions have said these are wrong ads. It's unfair that these are completely off the chart wrong. And so this just started in Northwest Ohio, but then has moved all around the country now.
Polls have been showing a tight race in Ohio, although in most the president has held on to a slim lead here. But the Senate race between incumbent Sherrod Brown and GOP challenger Josh Mandel seems to be less tight. Is this race Brown's to lose?
I think so. I just did a piece on this whole idea of ticket splitting. A lot of people do split the ticket when they vote, especially when it comes to the presidential race and then the U.S. Senate race or presidential race and congressional races. You've got certainly the polls showing a very close race between Obama and Romney, but a much wider gap between Mandel and Brown. And so that suggests that people might be voting for one candidate, but not the other. And, you know, Mandel has been sticking close on the heels of Mitt Romney throughout this campaign, I think in the hopes that he could ride Mitt Romney's coattails in a way. But the polling does suggest that maybe people might be voting for Romney and then voting for Brown. One political scientist I talked to said that he would not be surprised to see if Obama does lose Ohio, that Sherrod Brown still retains his seat.
A question about issue two, and that's the one that's the constitutional amendment to establish a 12-person group of state residents to handle the redrawing of legislative and congressional districts. We learned that opponents of the measure have outraised supporters by almost 2-1 last week. What does that tell us about the outcome of this measure?
I think that some polling has suggested that's actually going to be the result of the vote. That, you know, the only advertising many people have seen on issue two has been the opposition to issue two. The opposition is the Republican Party and some business groups and others who want to keep the map the congressional and state house maps the way that they are, if issue 2 did pass, then those maps would be thrown out, and then the map drawing process would be handed over to an independent citizens commission. There are a lot of people who are very suspicious of how that commission would work and say it's too complicated, and that because it's a constitutional amendment, it would be in the Constitution forever. And you know, the people who are backing that amendment say the system is screwed up and the map is terrible and something's got to change, and there's no guarantee that politicians will do that. But I think it doesn't look good for issue 2, just looking at some of the polling and obviously the spending, as you mentioned. I mean, the ads and the mailers that have been against issue 2 have overwhelmed the ones that are for it.
Tune in to WYSO on election night. Karen Kassler will join me for the latest results and analysis, and that'll begin 8 o'clock Tuesday night. Karen, thanks for being here today.
No problem. Thanks.
That's it for this week's edition of WYSO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next, the Book Nook.